Session number 26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Reel 3. We're talking about flying the Hudson, and you mentioned the self-flying device.
The autopilot.
The autopilot.
Yeah, the autopilot, which also is known as George. I don't know how it came to be known as George, but that was its name. The autopilot in British aircraft was never actually all that reliable, and you couldn't go away from the control column. You had to stand by it all the time. But the American autopilot, the Sperry autopilot, was absolutely trustworthy. And it was.
How did the two work? How did the British one work, and why wasn't it reliable? How did the American one work, and why was it reliable? What did they do for you as well?
Well, as far as the American one was concerned, it enabled you to fly a course, to fly straight and level, to do turns, and to generally relax. Now, my memory of the British one, I didn't have all that much experience, was that it really didn't do much more than simply keep the aircraft straight and level. And it didn't necessarily keep it all that level.
So not to be trusted. And the American, when you say it would fly a course, could you build in any factor for drift into it? Or
well, you allowed for the drift. I mean, if you there was the difference between your course and your track. The track is actually what you want to, if you're going from A to B, that's your track. Your course is what you steer in order to maintain that track.
Now, anything else about the conversion course? Did you make up the crews while you were there, or was that done when you joined your operational unit?
When I went through Silloth, there was no making up of crews. Later on, it did happen, but when I joined the squadron, we did not fly as crews.
Right, so nothing else about Silloth. Your next posting on the 18th of December 1940 was to 269 Squadron, which was at Wick.
Wick is at the very northernmost part of Scotland.
And what did you think when you got your posting? Was this what you wanted?
It was no surprise that there were maybe half a dozen Hudson squadrons in Coastal Command at the time, and clearly at the end of the course we were all going to go to one or other of the squadrons. And I happened to go to 269. Other people went to other squadrons. From memory, I was the only one who went to 269.
Now, what were your first impressions on joining the unit? You know, when you join a unit, that you get an impression, don't you?
Yeah,
what did
yeah.
you think of it?
Well, my first impression was that I met up with someone who had been with me at the JAR school and was ahead because I'd been off sick. And I asked him what the squadron was like, and the CO. And he said, the CO is an old fellow. He said he's 27 and married. So that gave me an insight as to what I was in for. Really, life in the Royal Air Force is like being in a club, and wherever you are, you're always made welcome as a new visitor or a new arrival.
Now, how would they make you welcome? You know, what would they do? You know, you arrive.
Well, I arrived, and it so happened that in my youth I had been bribed that if I didn't drink before I was 21, I would be given a certain amount of money. By the time I got to the squadron, I decided that, as I was already turned 21 by this time, there was no reason for remaining TT.
So you'd been teetotal right up to then?
Yes.
That must be quite unusual in
yes.
the RAF.
It was. The only exception were the brandies that I had to recover from my operation. But I was teetotal and I didn't smoke. However, I decided the time had come to do both. And I took counsel of fellow pilot officers in the squadron, and that evening in the mess we decided we would play snooker, and that they decided that the best way to start drinking was on Pimm's. So I drank Pimm's solidly all evening and was carried to bed. After that I never looked back.
You enjoyed drinking then?
I did very much, yes.
Was it a hard drinking mess? You know how I mean. I'm not. Some messes don't drink much. Other messes drink, but only socially. And then there are some messes that are out and out hard drinking.
In wartime, drinking was essentially a matter of relaxation. There was no question of whether it was a hard drinking or a soft drinking mess. You didn't drink to the stage that you became aggressive. I never ever met anyone in the RAF in the mess who was aggressive. I never met anyone in the mess who had to be quietly led aside because he was a nuisance. But yes, we drank and we thoroughly enjoyed our drinking.
So it's social drinking to get a little bit tipsy, a bit drunk, but not too far beyond.
No, well, the drinking was accompanied by singing. Singing was our great forte. And the repertoire of songs was enormous.
Now, was that just in that squadron, or was
it? I think, from my experience, I think probably 269 Squadron was rather exceptional. Because later on, when we went to Iceland, where we were entirely on our own and had to make our own entertainment, we were certainly not lacking in adding to the repertoire.
Who would write the... Sorry, I presume most of them would be parodies, would they?
Many of them were parodies. Many of them were, in fact, already existing songs that had been going in the RAF since the end of World War One. There were one or two parodies written directly concerned with things like the Hudson and Iceland and so on.
And who would write them? Would you write them?
No. Possibly our intelligence officer was as good as anyone at creating something new, but other songs just seemed to grow.
And you'd all be singing, would you? Roaring along.
Oh, yes, yes. And all taking it in turns. We used to have a little phrase in the midst of all this of saying to someone, come on, sing or show.
And what was showing?
Showing was, I suppose today, mooning.
And so you all took turns to lead.
Yes, indeed, it was a glorious sing-song.
And how obscene were the songs? Or were they mostly scatological or rude, or were some of them just lighter? Or what was the general mood of the song?
I suppose you could say that after the war, the kind of songs that you heard in a rugger club would not have been amiss.
Now, while we're on the officers' mess. You know, as we are. I mean, we're talking. We're at Wick, but we're going on fairly shortly to Iceland when you went to Caldanes. What was the officers' mess? Could you describe the building it was in, or the sort of setup it would be?
Well, the officers' mess at Wick was a typical wartime wooden officers' mess. Now, first of all, there was something quite interesting about Wick. Not known to very many people, Wick was a dry town, and unless you were an official resident at the railway hotel, you could not get a drink in Wick town. Needless to say, you could get a drink in the officers' mess at RAF Wick. So we had no difficulty at all in enticing ladies and some gentlemen from the town to come into the mess.
Now, what were the mess nights like? Would you have informal mess nights and formal mess nights, or did the two blur?
There was no formality at all in wartime in the Royal Air Force. We simply existed for the purpose of continuing with the war, and there was no mess routine as such. Nothing was organised.
So what would a typical mess night be like when you say had a couple of civilians in? And I mean...
Strangely enough, the only time I remember from the civilians' point of view was on a Sunday lunchtime. We had in the mess at the time a couple of Polish officers from PRU, and one of them was an extremely good pianist, and we had a grand piano in the anteroom, which was strange for a wooden mess. And Sunday lunchtimes were frequently a very pleasant social occasion, no heavy drinking, but with the piano and playing and meeting the local people.
And in the evening?
In the evenings just happened according to whether you were flying or not flying, according to the weather. I mean, an operation may be cancelled, and suddenly, instead of the being tense of the fact that you were about to go on a bombing raid in Norway, you're suddenly relieved of all that, and you're back in the mess, and the first thing you do is to enjoy a drink. And from there, the evening went on.
Would there be there weren't any formal dinners then? Meals were just meals?
Meals were just meals. There was none of the formality that existed before and after the war.
So no sitting around a table, no port, passing the port,
no,
toasts?
No.
What about mess games? You know the...
Well, mess games rather went along with the scene of the general evening of, I suppose, self-made entertainment.
What sort of thing? Which of the were they the sort of normal British Army ones, or did the RAF have its own?
Now let me think. The only one that comes to mind at the moment is a thing called "Are You There, Moriarty?" And I don't know if you've ever heard of that one, in which two people lie on the ground, on their tummies facing each other, at distance so that they are holding with their right hand. They're holding each of their hands. And with their left hand, they have a rolled-up newspaper, and they're blindfolded. And in turn, each one says, "Are you there, Moriarty?" And the other one says, "Yes." And you take a swipe at where you think his head is. And three strikes and you're out. That was one. The other thing I come to remember now was the question of Cardinal Puff. Now, Cardinal Puff was a qualification you earned through your drinking.
How did the game work? I think I've heard of it, but if you could just tell us.
A slightly complicated game in the sense that if you made a mistake, you had to go back to the beginning and have your pint filled up and start all over again. And it started off by saying you held your tankard with two fingers, your thumb and one finger, and you said, "I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff for the first time," and you took one sip and put the tankard down on the table. And then with two fingers on the handle, you lifted it up and said, "I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff, Puff, for the second time." And you took two sips and you put it down, bang, bang, on the table. And then you said, "I drink to the health," holding three fingers this time, "I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff, 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 for the third and last time." And you took three sips, in which the third sip emptied the glass. And you then went bang, bang, bang on the table and put the empty glass on the top of your head. And if you went through that without making a mistake, you had become a Cardinal Puff. If you did it three times in succession, you became an Arch-Cardinal. And remember that if you made the slightest mistake and everyone was watching, you had to go back to the beginning, have your glass filled up and start again.
And of course, as you drank more, you became more likely to make mistakes.
Yes.
Now, tell me about some of the characters in the squadron when you first arrived. Anybody stand out in your mind, either senior officers or just friends?
Yeah. It's rather difficult to answer that question because with the continual throughput of pilots, either because they had failed to return from a mission or because they were tour expired, you were never in contact long enough to establish what you might call long-standing friendships, although some certainly developed in the sense that after the war we continued to see each other. But at the time, friendship was, to a great extent, the person you shared a room with. And one of the people I shared a room with, which was a very sad occasion in a way, was a PRU pilot who went under the name of Pilot Officer Suckling, and because he was about 21 and very blonde, it was unfortunate to have such a name. But he was in fact a magnificent Spitfire pilot who took the very first long-range Spitfire unarmed out over Trondheim and identified the Bismarck being there, which led to the entire Bismarck incident. Unfortunately, on the second occasion he went out that way, he never came back.
And he shared a room with you?
Yes.
What was he like as a chap?
Oh, charming, a very pleasant fellow. We were all young pilots, we were all keen pilots, we were there because we wanted to be pilots, and so we all had a lot in common. At no time can I ever remember anyone in the unit being a person I couldn't get on with.
So you didn't particularly then make close friendships with people, you didn't have the time.
No,
but you were friendly with everybody as far as...
Yes.
And what about, what was your sort of relationship like with the airmen, the fitters, the engines, the people who looked at the engines, the rest of it?
I suppose, with hindsight, that relationship wasn't what as good as it should be. We were really only interested in getting into the aeroplane and going off on the operation and coming back and reporting the condition of the aircraft to the ground crew and leaving it to them. We did see a fair amount of the NCO air crew and therefore the other NCOs, because we used to go and have drinks in the Sergeant Smith's from time to time. But the kind of welfare that would be expected of an officer after the war didn't exist during the war.
So they were just a bunch of people who looked after the planes? And
yes.
There was a twain should meet, almost.
Yes, yes.
How about your senior officers? I don't know whether you remember either your flight commander or your squadron commander, but if you don't remember them by name, what were they good officers? You know, I mean, did they impress you with their abilities?
I was never unimpressed by the ability of anyone in my squadron. I consider that all of them were absolutely capable of doing the job they were employed to do.
Well, let's look at that job then. What was the job? You were flying Hudson, and you were at Wick when you joined, late December, 18th of December. What were the missions you were sent on?
In 269 Squadron, when I joined it, I was a pilot navigator, and this was the standard in Coastal Command at the time. Pilots were also navigators. We did not have separate navigators in the squadron. The result was that when we flew with two pilots, we would take it in turns to pilot one day and navigate the next. Now, when I first started, my first operational mission was on the 1st of January 1941, escorting a convoy in the Pentland Firth, where I was navigating.
Now, well, let's look at the convoy duties then. You may not remember mission by mission now, or no. I thought so. But when you were on convoy, escorting a convoy, what did you do?
Well, the first thing you had to do was to meet the convoy. In the Pentland Firth, of course, it wasn't very difficult, but out in the middle of the Atlantic, you frequently never met the convoy, either because of their navigation not being where they should have been or your navigation not being where it should be. And this was particularly the case when you were the first to escort a convoy that had been out in the area that was outside the area that Coastal Command could cover in those days. Having met the convoy, by Aldous Lamp, you more or less checked in with the escort. Frequently there was only one escort. There may at times have been more than one, but frequently there was only one and maybe 30 or 40 ships in the convoy. You checked in simply by flashing the letter of the day, and he knew that you'd then taken over. Now, the purpose of the exercise was to prevent U-boats from attacking the convoy. So your objective was to keep the U-boat submerged. A submerged U-boat in those days could only do about 6 knots maximum for an hour, or 2 knots for maybe 6 or 8 hours. On the surface, they could do 16 knots.
So if you could keep them submerged.
So the purpose of the exercise really was to let them see you so that they would submerge. On the other hand, of course, you were looking for them, and if you could get to them soon enough, you could attack them. But it was very rare that you saw a submarine on the surface, and it was extremely rare just to be able to see a periscope.
So the idea was you'd force them to submerge, and then that would reduce their whole ability to intercept the convoy, because
yes,
they'd only have a very small speed difference.
Yes, yes, indeed. It reduced their ability. Obviously, your first aim was to sink a U-boat rather than just to scare it off. But that was much easier said than done. On one occasion, I was detailed to escort off Scarpa Flow the new battleship King George V, which was undergoing its final trials. And it was being escorted by a county-class cruiser, the Norfolk. When we got to where the ships were, it was very low cloud and very poor visibility. And as I flew round these two ships to establish contact, I flashed the letter of the day, and the Norfolk, which was the escort, came back saying, wrong letter. So I fired the colour of the day with the very pistol, and they came back and said, wrong colour. Then they called me up on the lamp and said, deeply regret having fired one round at you, which was very kind of them. I never saw it at all. When I got back to base, it turned out that the operations room at Wick had been using the wrong code book since the beginning of the month, and that every aircraft operating from Wick up to that time had the wrong letter and the wrong colour of the day.
So it could have been a serious blunder.
Oh, yes.
Any other types of mission you were flying from Wick?
In those days, Coastal Command was not involved simply in anti-submarine warfare, which became very much the major part of its work later on. Our task was reconnaissance, general reconnaissance, and this included reconnaissance of the Norwegian coastline. So we used to go off on reconnaissance of the Norwegian coastline, and on one occasion at night I was dropping leaflets over Bergen. I have no idea what they said. And we were entitled to attack any shipping we saw going down the coast of Norway, but I actually never saw any ships.
This dropping leaflets, do you do a lot of that?
No. No, it was the only occasion I ever did any leaflet dropping.
Now, what were you looking for on the reconnaissance missions? And the answer's probably everything, but I mean, weren't photographing it, you were just recording.
Yes, we were doing visual reconnaissance, and it was mainly a question of for any kind of shipping movements, but particularly naval units.
Were there any naval units in particular you were looking for? I mean, were you looking for I'm not sure, it was the Bismarck and things like that?
Well, yes, the Germans were using North Norway as an operating base for the German Navy. And consequently, there were ships in transit and submarines in transit to Trondheim.
But you didn't sight any?
No.
Now, you mentioned bombing missions.
Yes.
Did you go on the Norwegian coast? Did you do any of that?
I did go on one mission, but it actually turned out in the end to be more or less abortive. But there was one mission, or a number of missions that the squadron did before I arrived, which were involved in the Norwegian campaign, in which they were attacking the Gneisenau and other ships and lost a number of aircraft in carrying out these raids. Just after I arrived at Christmas in 1940, the squadron was detailed to attack a hotel on the railway line between Oslo and Bergen at a place called Finse, which was at the top of the hill of the mountains, where it was believed that the German general staff were spending Christmas. The raid was carried out during the night, but was not very successful.
You weren't on this one?
No. Not very successful, since the thickness of the ice caused many of the bombs simply to bounce off the ice. The raid that I was on was an attack on a power station in Hardanger Fjord. The plan was a very elementary and a very impractical plan for three aircraft to fly up the fjord in darkness at 500 feet and drop incendiaries on the target, which was at the base of mountains all round, whilst I was detailed to be one of the three to fly higher and drop high incendiary bombs and drop high explosive bombs on the target. The weather conditions over the target area were so impossible the raid was aborted.
Had you got any sort of bombing sites by then for these high raid things?
Well, we had the standard bomb site, the same as the one that we had in our Oxfords when we did training there.
Now, we haven't talked about crews much. What was the crew of the thing, and how was it organised? Because I noted you said you didn't have a regular crew.
The crew of a Hudson consisted of two pilot navigators and two wireless operator air gunners. So the pilots alternated between piloting and navigating, and the WAP AGs alternated between being air gunners and wireless operators. In practice, we usually flew as a pair of pilots and a pair of WAP AGs, but not necessarily as the same crew. But we were always in the same flight. The squadron at that time had three flights, A, B, and C, so that the people that I flew with, I was in B flight, were always other B flight personnel.
Now, why was it? Because in bomber command, they'd have the same crew almost every time. Why had Coastal Command, or why had this squadron gone that way? Was there any reason, or was it just because it had always been that way?
I have no idea in an answer to that question. At the time that I joined 269 Squadron, that was the way it was done, and I had never thought that it would be otherwise. There had never been any suggestion to me that we formed up as a crew and flew as a crew. I didn't know what went on in Bomber Command. That was a different organisation altogether. And I got the impression that what 269 were doing was the same as everyone else.
Any other things you remember about the raids or operations you did from WIC before we moved to Iceland?
No. What I do remember is that we were bombed at WIC by the Luftwaffe on one or two occasions.
Tell me about that.
Well, there were a bit of a hit and miss. The aircraft flew in, dropped the bombs and flew off again. And that was it. And they, in one case, hit the end of a hangar and knocked a wall down, but no very great damage was done. The Germans used to send a reconnaissance aircraft out on a fairly regular basis over the Shetland Isles and North Scotland. In fact, just before Christmas, just about the time I arrived, a German aircraft had been shot down and landed on Fair Isle, and the crew were then ferried down to WIC for onward transmission to a prison camp. And as it was Christmas Day, we entertained them in the mess for Christmas lunch.